Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. I didn't see you there. This is Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo. I'm sorry for popping out of the shadows like I did.
Oh. So we be drinking. We've been drinking.
Yes.
And we be swearing. For those of you who don't know, Beyond Reproach is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. Today, we are drinking White Russians.
Sure are.
Oddly enough, both of our stories today are from the 1970s.
Yes.
This is another one of those things where this was not planned, but it just worked out that way, that we're both doing stories from the 70s. And to celebrate,
we are drinking. I fear people don't believe us. We're just merging into one person, you guys.
Hive mind.
Be cool with it.
Beyond reproach, hive mind. So to celebrate the 1970s, we are drinking White Russians.
Yes, and I'm dressed as a Black Panther.
Yes, true story. She's literally all in black with a black beret.
Yes.
I talked about wearing a leisure suit, but I don't actually own one. So that didn't happen. I used to, though.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, I had a leisure suit that I bought as a Halloween costume from Salvation Army. For those of you who don't know, a White Russian is made with vodka, Kahlua, and cream. Everyone knows that.
Everyone.
If you go online and look up a recipe for a White Russian, it's going to say heavy cream. Originally, though, when the recipe was first written down, what they would have traditionally been using is called light cream.
Okay.
So it's not like heavy whipping cream.
Half and half?
So it's really hard to find light cream now. You can sometimes find
it. Oh, I've seen light cream.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just
what
not.
What is that?
It has less butterfat than heavy cream. So it's sort of like between half and half and heavy cream, I think.
Okay.
But my store didn't have light cream, so we are drinking them with half and half.
I love half and half.
And you know what? This will be episode 30. Today is episode 30. And this is our first ever vodka cocktail. Ever. We've never had a cocktail with vodka in it on this show before.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So cheers.
Cheers.
To drunkenness.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
It needs to be stirred a little bit because the Kahlua
is all the way at the bottom.
It looks pretty when it sort of separates like that.
I love the separation.
Yeah, but you need to stir it to get the full flavor. So what do you think?
I like it. I have not had a White Russian since college.
Me too. I can't remember the last time I had one.
I liked them at the time. We'll see.
Kahlua is super sweet.
It is sweet.
Yeah.
It's okay though.
Yeah. It's not bad.
It's like an old person drink.
I'm still having issues with my sense of smell. It's starting to come back and things that smell gross don't smell as gross as they used to, but
So it's fading.
It's fading.
That's good.
But I still can't smell coffee or taste coffee.
That is wild to me that you can smell a bag of coffee and get no smell.
Literally, I stuck my nose in a bag of coffee beans.
The coffee and is so
it's
strong.
Like drink. It's like breathing air.
Yeah. And it's not like you have like Folgers.
No,
you
know? No, like literally fresh coffee beans from like a roaster. So to me, this kind of just tastes like sweet milk and booze.
But you can't taste the spiciness a little? There's
a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can kind of taste, like there's something there, but I don't taste coffee. But
it's delicious.
Yeah.
It's very drinkable.
There's a reason it was so popular, and it has been so popular, you know.
Yeah.
So the White Russian, the recipe does not come from Russia.
What?
There's nothing particularly Russian about a White Russian.
Other than it's vodka? Is that why?
It's because it's made with vodka, yes.
Like that's stupid.
Yes. Okay. So because this is our first ever vodka cocktail, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of vodka in the U.S.
Okay.
After the Russian Revolution in the early 1920s, Vladimir Smirnov was the only member of the Smirnov vodka empire in Russian to actually escape the Russian Revolution and move away. Mm-hmm. He escaped Moscow and he moved to France. And in France, he tried to set up a new Smirnov distillery in France and get French people to drink Russian vodka or Smirnov vodka. Was trying to build like an international market for it, wanted to export it to other countries.
So were they only drinking vodka in Russia at this point? No one in Europe was drinking vodka?
No one was drinking Russia.
Stop it.
So this is the problem. He's trying to do this. And
but they had gin, and gin comes from vodka.
Gin was really the only clear spirit that anyone drank outside of Russia. No one was drinking vodka. Wow. People thought of it as strange and unknown and foreign. And it's very specifically Russian. Only Russian people drink vodka. So it was like a weird thing to for him to try and get people to drink vodka in France, and it did not work. And he kind of lost a lot of money on it and was basically destitute because of it. And then in 1925, another like young distiller, also from Russia, who had also escaped the revolution, was passing through France.
Is this Stolichnaya?
No. This is another. So he wasn't like a famous person.
Oh, okay.
Or from a vodka brand. But he met up with Smirnoff, Vladimir Smirnoff, and was like, I want to buy the rights to Smirnoff vodka in the United States and in Canada from you. And he's like, well, it's prohibition, so you can't really distribute it in the U.S. anyways. And I'm not making any money, and I'm fucking poor as shit. So sure, you can buy these rights. And then he kind of was making it in Canada and was able to actually build a market. In 1930, the Savoy Cocktail Book, which the Savoy Hotel in London, put out this cocktail book that had one recipe in it for a cocktail that included vodka. One recipe in the entire book. And it wasn't just a straight up vodka cocktail. It also had gin in it and some other stuff.
Oh, okay.
But the cocktail was just called The Russian. Because it was made with vodka.
So that's all it took.
Yeah. So most drinks after this had, if they were named either something with Russia in the name or some kind of a nod to Russia, if they were made with vodka, like a Moscow Mule.
Mm.
It's called a Moscow Mule because it's made with vodka.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then in 1949, a bartender in Belgium added coffee liqueur to vodka and made a Black Russian. But the White Russian didn't come until a little bit later. By the 1950s, vodka was finally starting to take off in the U.S. There was a market for it, finally.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the 60s, during the Cold War, there was this huge anti-Russian sentiment. So all these advertisers... Yeah, exactly. Russia. So all these advertisers started trying to rebrand Smirnoff vodka as like an international beverage that had no ties to Russia.
No ties.
Like, forget about Russia. Nothing about Russia. So they started making up all these ads with these like British and American celebrities in the ads, kind of like drinking vodka as they do like international Playboy, kind of like, I'm a man and I'm, you know, drinking.
Drinking vodka as men do.
Yeah. And this is actually part of the reason why most of the James Bond movies after 1962 have him ordering vodka martinis.
Oh, my God.
While he is simultaneously fighting against the USSR. Yeah.
Wow. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's strong branding.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Okay. So, and the campaign worked.
Clearly.
And by the 1970s, vodka sales made up one-third of all U.S. liquor sales.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. By the 70s because of this branding.
Wow.
And Smirnoff, at this point in the 70s, was still the only vodka brand that people even knew. There weren't real competitors yet. 99.5% of domestic distribution of vodka was done by Smirnoff Vodka.
Wow.
By 1976, for the first time ever, vodka surpassed whiskey in sales of liquor in the U.S. And now to this day, vodka is America's favorite spirit.
It is.
America drinks more vodka than anything else to this day. And has since the 70s, the late 70s.
But by like a lot?
Enough of a margin that it's, quantifiable. We're in the minority.
Weird.
We're drinking 30 episodes in and drinking vodka for the first time ever.
What are people drinking? They're drinking straight vodka?
Probably vodka cranberry, soda? Vodka soda.
Oh.
A lot people love a vodka cranberry. But then like think about like martini, all those like flavored martinis, Cosmos, everything has vodka in it.
People aren't drinking Cosmos anymore.
Well, they'll find something to drink vodka with.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Well, vodka tastes like nothing, so I guess it can just be...
And that's part of the branding, too, is like...
blended into anything.
Exactly.
For people, especially, who don't like the taste of
exactly.
alcohol.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I understand completely. Okay.
So then back to the White Russian. The recipe was first published in the Oakland Tribune in 1965. The recipe in this article called for 1 ounce each Southern vodka cream. So
that?
Southern at the time referred to, it was called coffee Southern, which was at the time was a popular brand of coffee liqueur that was made by Southern Comfort. It's no longer around. It's gone out of business. But Southern Comfort used to make a coffee liqueur, and they published for the first time ever the recipe for the White Russian. It's not clear if Southern Comfort's like marketing team actually came up with the White Russian, or if people had already been adding cream to Black Russians for a long time and they were just the first ones to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, it took a couple years. This was published in 1965. It didn't really take off until the 70s, but in the 70s, people fucking loved a White Russian.
Wow.
Everyone was drinking them because they're strong.
They are strong.
The recipe is really easy to remember because it's equal parts cream, vodka, Kahlua.
Oh, it's equal parts.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's, so it's easy to remember.
Anyone can make
it. It's easy to make.
Yeah.
It's easy to drink.
Yeah.
It's sweet. It's creamy.
Damn.
Yeah.
Okay.
So people in the 70s were all about a White Russian. After the 70s, the popularity kind of started to wane. And by like the 90s, no one was really drinking them anymore.
Yeah.
Until The Big Lebowski came out in 1998.
Yes.
And completely revived the White Russian. Like, nobody would be drinking them right now if it weren't for the dude.
Yeah.
In drinking all those White Russians in The Big Lebowski. But yeah, that's the story of the White Russian.
That is really interesting.
Has absolutely nothing to do with Russia.
I'm shook.
Yeah. Gooped.
Gooped. Who knew?
Who knew?
I mean, I bought into the branding.
Yeah,
I just
exactly.
assumed.
Yeah.
They got me. Okay, so my story this episode revolves around the first white entertainer to use his pelvis on the TV.
Elvis?
Correct. The man who most famously appropriated black music for a white audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about a king. The king.
The king.
Not Christ. I don't know that girl. The king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley.
Oh.
So my scandal is about the time when he met President Richard Nixon and begged to become a federal narcotics agent.
I do know this story.
Okay.
What a fun story.
It's the best story.
This.
So on December 21st, 1970, Elvis popped by the White House for a little chat and a big ask. He wanted in on the newly minted war on drugs. So the details of this literally inexplicable meeting come from memoirs, interviews, firsthand accounts, biographer notes, and recently released White House documents. Just as a disclaimer, this is by far the most absurd historic event, excluding, of course, the last 4 years of this waking nightmare that I've ever come across. But before we start, I just want to do a toast.
Yes.
A toast.
To peanut butter and banana sandwiches with bacon.
That's right. You like those. Let us raise our glass to drugs.
Yay. Ooh, you don't have to make me. You don't have to right. tell me twice.
This story began innocently enough a few days prior with an argument over money. So Elvis's father, Vernon, and his wife, Priscilla, got really mad at him because he had spent over $100,000 in one L.A. shopping spree.
Oh, my.
Yes. He bought 32 guns and 10 Mercedes Benzes.
32 guns?
Correct. 32 guns and 10 Benzes.
What do you need 10 cars for in one fell swoop?
You give them away as gifts. Don't you
really?
Know? Yeah. He was annoyed that his father and his wife were kind of like getting on his back for this amount of money that he thought was kind of like chump change.
Yeah.
So he bounces. Like, he leaves Graceland. He's rocking a wild purple velvet suit, carrying a few of the guns that he just bought. He drove to the airport and caught the next available flight, just on a whim.
With all those guns?
Correct. He only grabbed a few of them, but yes. Yeah.
Oh, the 70s.
Right?
What a wild time
right?
to be alive.
So
holy
he,
shit.
He jumps on the next available flight. It just so happened to be to D.C.
Okay.
On a whim, because, you know, drugs.
When I'm mad at my husband, I will leave the house and go take a walk.
Wait,
I'm not
going
to fly to D.C.
You don't go to JFK and go to, you don't grab your guns and go.
I mean, I guess I don't have $100,000 to just like throw away on cars and shit. So
Priscilla, she wrote in her memoirs, this is a quote, "We were mystified. For the first time, he was traveling alone without even one bodyguard. Elvis didn't even know his own phone number, nor did he carry cash. How was he going to get around?"
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah, not having cash on you back then was like, nobody took credit cards.
Exactly. Like, yeah. Exactly. This whole story is insane. So despite all of this, he still hopped a flight to D.C. and he checked into the Hotel Washington under the name John Burroughs. I don't know what money he had. I don't know how he bought this flight. I don't know how he got a hotel room. I'm guessing because he's Elvis.
Yeah, I'm sure that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that if Elvis walked up to your front desk and was like, I'm John Burroughs, they'd be like, okay, Elvis. Here's yeah, I know, right?
Exactly. Oh, but he didn't stay in D.C. long. So there are a few slightly different theories on why he abruptly left D.C., all of which kind of paint the same picture. According to the Smithsonian, he just got bored. He got to D.C. He didn't have any of his homies around. He's just like, what do I do here?
What do you do in D.C.? If you're not
politics,
yeah. If you're not a politician,
yeah. What do you do as Elvis in a crushed velvet suit in just a random hotel by yourself?
Yeah,
with no money,
drugs.
There you go. You be knowing. So, the Washington Post said that he had developed an itchy facial rash, so he wanted to find a doctor.
Okay.
In L.A.
In L.A. Okay.
As one does.
Where? Tennessee.
Yeah, he was in Memphis, then he went to D.C., and now he's going to L.A.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because he needed to find a doctor.
Sure.
Don't you know?
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that's where all the doctors live.
Absolutely.
They don't have doctors in D.C.
They don't.
Just politicians.
It's a little known fact they don't. according to Politico, and I think all of these stories are kind of true. According to Politico, Elvis just wanted to, like, hang out with his West Coast friends. Like, he had got to D.C., yeah. He was all alone. He wanted to, like, go scoop up his homies.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he flew to L.A. to pick up his longtime friend, a man named Jerry Skilling. So this dude arrives at LAX at 3 a.m. Again, I don't know how he was called. There's no cell phones, but somehow word has gotten to him. And he picks Elvis up at 3 a.m. and takes him back to his mansion because he had a mansion in L.A.
Okay. Good for
right?
him.
Yeah. Good sure. for him. Yeah. You know.
He made a lot of movies, mm-hmm. so I'm sure he would have Royalties. Had to have had. Well, no, he would have needed like a home base.
Oh, in I LA. See what you mean. Yeah. Okay.
He was very active in the in filmmaking in the 60s and 70s.
I did not know that. Yeah,
they're terrible. I've seen a few of them. They're really. It's all like teeny bopper bullshit. I mean, like it's.
Are there good movies that were made in the 60s?
There are okay. some, not a lot, but there are some.
Name one.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Okay, that is a good movie.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought I could stump you. Clearly, I don't know who you are. Shame on me. Yeah. You could probably name 10 movies. Yeah. So he's in L.A. So the two men, they hung out for a night. And then they packed up some guns, some more guns. And they caught a red eye back to D.C.
I'm shook that Elvis was all about those guns.
It's coming. I'm gonna dive into that next, actually. Okay. So flying back to DC, they just so happened to be on the same flight as Senator George Murphy, who was a California senator at the time, who previously was like an actor.
Okay.
But he acted in like shitty movies and musicals.
Okay.
So the two of them on this red eye flight, they kind of hit it off. They're talking about politics. Some people speculate that it was Murphy that inspired what came next.
Okay.
I don't really think so, but a bit of background on late stage Elvis. My guy was obsessed with guns.
I had no idea.
Obsessed with guns and collecting police badges.
Really?
Okay. He was 7 years old, you guys.
Yeah.
So he was made an honorary police officer of dozens of police departments across the nation. Really? He made friends with cops everywhere he went. Because he was always donating to police associations and also just donating to police departments. Yeah. So his passion went even further because he bought a police scanner, a radio, and a flashing blue light.
Oh, no.
So he started patrolling the streets of Memphis.
What?
Occasionally pulling over speeding cars. He'd give them a lecture, an autograph, and then he'd drive off. And they'd all be so fucking confused.
Like Elvis just pulled me over.
Yes.
What's happening?
Yes.
Is this real life?
Because drugs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So he became fixated on getting a federal badge, one that certified him as an agent of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, which was the precursor to the DEA.
Okay.
This narc badge to him was like a symbol of like ultimate power.
Yeah.
According to Priscilla, she wrote this in her memoirs. He believed he could legally enter any country, both wearing guns and carrying any drugs he wished.
If he had a badge. He's like, it's cool. I'm a DEA agent.
Yeah, look at this.
Or whatever.
I got it. Yeah. Yeah. BNDD. Yeah.
So he thought if he was a, what was it called again? It wasn't DEA, but.
Like, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs.
Okay. So if he belonged, if he had a badge, yes. Then he could just have drugs on him.
Correct.
At any time. He's correct. Like, it's cool.
In any country in the world. Yeah. Like, I got this. Like, I'm on the job.
I'm a federal agent. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Okay.
So getting this BNDD badge would combine two of Elvis's favorite hobbies. One, collecting police paraphernalia, obviously, and also just popping pills.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So he used opiates, codeine, as well as Quaaludes. He also dabbled in antihistamines.
Really?
Which I thought, like, I mean, they do make you feel a little woozy.
But not in a fun way.
Apparently to him. Okay. But I think when you mix all of them together, sure. It can okay. be really fun, yeah. I think. So, yeah, antihistamines, tranquilizers like Valium, barbiturates, sleeping pills, hormones, and laxatives. These were all things damn. That he were just mixing together. And
weird. I guess I know he had a lot of like digestive problems, so I don't know if the laxatives were like for fun, but still.
Yeah.
What the hormones? What? Whatever.
Yeah.
You do you, Elvis.
Yeah. I guess like testosterone, like makes yeah. you feel a certain. I don't fucking know. He was doing an experiment on himself. Sure, it seems yeah. like. So while flying cross country, he had gotten himself pretty worked up talking to Senator Murphy about what he saw was the moral decline of America.
Oh, Jesus.
He was on a mission, don't you know, Elvis. To save the country from the scourge he saw sweeping it. Can you guess what this scourge was?
Oh, God, drugs?
I mean, yes and no. It's the usual. It's the left.
Yeah.
Hippies.
Okay. Yeah, okay, okay.
He was talking about hippies, Students for a Democratic Society, the SDS, and, of course, you know, the Black Panther Party. Because he loves guns, but not for black people.
Uh-huh.
He would later include the Beatles on the list. He fucking hated the Beatles. I'm going to get into this later. He had like a hate boner for them, for sure.
Weird. Okay.
So Murphy, just hearing Elvis's passion about, you know, this scourge, he offered to make an appointment for Elvis with the BNDD.
Wow.
He's okay. like, I'll get you in. Like, it's cool. It's cool. But Elvis was like, nah, man, I got this. I'm going to do this myself. So he took out a pen and he scribbled a letter to Nixon.
I mean, he's Elvis. Yeah.
And I say scribbled literally because he asked for American Airlines stationery. That's where this letter was written on. I kid you not, on five pages of
six. 5 pages?
It's little, you know. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's like the little notepads. Notepad. Yeah, yeah, okay, it's okay. A little notepad.
Okay.
So he's he got what he had been feeling off his spirit. He wanted to be made a federal agent so he could do what he did best. Going undercover.
Because he's Elvis.
Nobody knows who he is. Don't look at me like that, Tux.
Oh, my God.
Drugs, man. Drugs. So his letter was written like one big drug-fueled stream of consciousness. There are no paragraph breaks. There's the weirdest, most confusing capitalizations. Like, it's almost tweet-like.
Yeah. Wow.
It's so bizarre. It looks like it was written by a child.
I love this story.
This story is really fun.
I have never smiled for this long of a period of time.
Your face is going to hurt. I was so happy when I found this story.
This is incredible.
Right?
Oh, my God.
So I'm going to read the letter in full just because it's short.
Yeah.
Even though it was 5 pages, yeah, it's really short. Pages. And it's like, shit is insane. So okay. It starts. Actually, I'm going to have a sip.
I was just going to say, you need to take a drink.
Yeah.
Loosen those jaw gums.
Okay, it starts. Dear Mr. President, first I would like to introduce myself. I am Elvis Presley, and I admire you and have great respect for your office. Have great respect, all capitalized.
Okay, it really is like a tweet.
Yes, I talked to Vice President Agnew in Palm Springs a week ago and expressed my concern for our country. The drug culture, all capitalized, the hippie elements, all capitalized, the SDS, Black Panthers, etc., do not consider me as their enemy, or as they call it, the establishment. The establishment, capitalized.
Uh-huh.
I call it America, and I love it. Love is capitalized. Sir, I can and will be of any service, service is capitalized, that I can to help the country out. I have no concerns or motives other than helping the country out. So I wish not to be given a title or an appointed position. I can and will do more good if I were made a federal agent at large, all capitalized. And I will help out by doing it my way through my communications with people of all ages. First and foremost, foremost is capitalized. I am an entertainer, but all I need is the federal is capitalized credentials. I am on the plane is capitalized with Senator George Murphy, and we is capitalized have been discussing the problems that our country is faced with.
I can't take it.
It's a lot. I'm like halfway through.
I am on the plane.
Okay.
Oh, I can't take it. Okay.
So, sir, I am staying is capitalized, at the Washington Hotel in room 505, 506, and 507. I have two men who work with me by the name of Jerry Skilling and Sonny West. I am registered under the name John Burroughs. I will be here for as long as it takes to get the credentials of a federal agent, both capitalized. I have done an in-depth study of drug abuse. Drug abuse is capitalized.
By abusing drugs.
And communist brainwashing techniques, all capitalized. What? And I am right in the middle of the whole thing, where I can and will do the most good. I am glad is capitalized, to help, just so long as it is kept very private. Private is capitalized. You can have your staff or whomever call me anytime today, tonight, or tomorrow. Tomorrow is capitalized. I was just nominated the coming year for... Shit. Okay. I was nominated the coming year one of America's 10 most outstanding young men. America's 10 most capitalized. That will be January 18th in my hometown, two words, both capitalized, of Memphis, Tennessee. I am sending you the short autobiography about myself so you can better understand this approach. I would love to meet you just to say hello if you're not too busy. Respectfully, Elvis Presley. P.S. Oh. I believe that you, sir is capitalized, were one of the top 10 outstanding men of America, also all capitalized. I have a personal gift for you, also which I would like to present to you, and you can accept it or I will keep it for you until you can take it.
Do we know what this gift was?
It's coming.
Okay.
It's a coming. So they landed in Washington, D.C. a little bit before 6 a.m. and they hopped into a rented limo and they drove directly to the White House gates, where Elvis himself gets out of the car and hands these 5 notes to really confused guards.
Yeah.
Gets back into his limo and goes to his hotel to await an answer.
Oh my God. Okay. This is the best story I've ever heard.
The most insane shit I've ever researched in my life. Like, no hyperbole. This is... Nothing makes sense. Nothing at all makes sense. But also, I love it so much. So he goes back to the hotel, and I'm just kind of pause there.
Okay.
So the appointment secretary to Nixon, a man named Dwight Chapin, he wrote a piece in Politico in December, and that's how I found out about this story.
Okay.
He says that he's the reason why this meeting took place at all. He first thought it was a goof.
Yeah.
He thought that his coworkers were playing a joke on him because he was part of this group called the Brotherhood. It was made up of just young White House aides.
Okay.
Who just like playing jokes on each other.
Yeah.
And it's December 21st, so it's around the holidays. Sure. Not so many people around. Like, this is when they had the most fun.
Yeah.
So okay. They're like, okay, someone's pulling my leg.
Yeah.
He wasn't 100% sure that it was a joke.
Uh-huh.
So he's like, okay, I guess I should talk to someone else about this. So he thought that potentially, like, if it was real, it could be a really good, like, publicity stunt.
Sure.
Basically.
Yeah.
So this is a quote from the article. in Politico. He said it wasn't unheard of for people to show up at the White House gate expecting to see the president. Unlike your average Americans dropping by an in-laws or a neighbor's house carrying a cake, these were people who felt that they were important enough to get an unannounced meeting with the president. Or they were a little on the nutty side. Sometimes both. Most of the time they were politely sent away, but sometimes, as is in this case, the guards at the gate would take down the relevant information and route the request through my office.
Okay.
So he was like the Nixon, you know, secretary.
Sure, yeah.
So from there, he looped in a man named Bud Crowe. Krug? I think his name is Crowe. I'm just going to call him Bud. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. So he was working on a White House program that was trying to get celebrities to publicly denounce drugs and like become part of like a marketing campaign.
Sure. Sort of like proto Just Say No.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So Bud was the head of this program, and he just so happened to be a huge Elvis fan. So okay. just hearing about it, he's like, fuck yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, sight unseen. He's like, we're doing this.
We need this.
Yeah. yeah. So he, according to him, he said, like, Chapman and I figured out we ought to make this appointment because one of these guys is the president of the United States, and the other one is the king of the Western world.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah. So Chapman, he drafted a memo to the White House chief of staff, a man named H.R. Haldeman. So he was kind of the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
So urging Nixon to meet with Elvis.
Yeah.
Like, the two of them agreed. They're like, okay, we're going to send this up the chain. So in the memo, he said, it would be wrong to push Presley off on the vice president since it will take very little of the president's time and it can be extremely beneficial for the president to build some rapport with Presley. He added that if the president wants to meet with some bright young people outside the government, Presley might be a perfect one to start with. Sure,
sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the margin next, like in this in this memo, the chief of staff, he writes, and I will put this on Instagram, he writes, you must be kidding.
Yeah, seriously.
He's just like, this is insane. But still, he approved the meeting. But his one ask is that Bud screen him first.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's like, this man is clearly crazy.
Yeah, we're not just going to have him roll up into the Oval Office.
Yeah.
Like, no.
No, this dude is sending tweets and tweets don't even exist yet.
Yeah.
What is happening?
Yeah. So Elvis, meanwhile, he was not at his hotel. He had taken a limo to the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs.
What?
He just went there. He's like, I'm going to talk to them. He just couldn't wait for Nixon.
Yeah.
So somehow, somehow he managed to get a meeting with the deputy director of the BNDD. I don't know how.
What?
The head of it. He gets a meeting with him somehow. And the man is named John Finletter. So Elvis, he pitched his idea. He volunteered to fight the war on drugs. And he offered to even donate $5,000 to assist the Bureau in their fight.
Okay.
All he wanted in return was just a badge.
Yeah.
You know, come on, man. Like, be cool about it. Finletter was not cool about it.
He said,
no, I don't want your fucking money and like, you're not getting a badge.
Get out of here. Yeah.
Good day, sir.
Yeah.
So Elvis is heartbroken. He
like,
calls.
Are you high? Like, no.
Elvis, he calls his fan Skilling and he is crying. He's telling him what happened.
Oh,
crying. Yeah. He's so upset that he was just told no. Thankfully, Nixon had called the hotel and agreed to the meeting.
Dry those crocodile tears.
Yes. So the pre-screen meeting with Bud was scheduled for 8:45 in his office offsite. Like, he wasn't working in the White House. He had an office somewhere else. So Bud would take Elvis over to the West Wing if all went well.
Mm-hmm.
Bud was, again, a really big Elvis fan, but he wasn't trying to lose his job over this.
Sure.
He was a little bit nervous about anyone who would just roll up to the White House unannounced.
Yeah.
He got even more nervous when the Secret Service called him saying that Elvis had arrived for the meeting carrying a gun.
Are you fucking kidding me? Of course.
Literally carrying a gun. Elvis had under his arm a box vintage Colt 45 complete with bullets lined up next to the gun in the frame. It was to be a gift for the president.
This is the
gift.
Oh my God.
This is the gift.
What
I'm glad that you didn't
job.
Know. Thank you. I'm glad that you didn't know this because I'm like, everyone knows this story. Okay, this is great. So he had flown from L.A. to D.C. with three concealed handguns, all of which he had permits for. Thankfully, he left those in the limo. He didn't bring those into the meeting, but he brought a box. So the box 45, he grabbed on a whim. like as he was heading out the door, according to his man Schilling, he grabbed it from his desk without a word as they were heading out the door. He grabbed it like he was grabbing an umbrella.
Yeah. I might need this.
I might need this vintage gun with the bullets, you know?
In a gift box.
In a gift box. So after a short back and forth between the Secret Service and Bud, Elvis was allowed to bring in his box and have this meeting.
Okay. It's
like, is everyone on drugs? Yeah, the 70s was crazy.
Yeah.
Anything went, clearly, even at this high level. So the screening went well. Bud felt like Elvis was completely genuine in his requests. He was really genuine in wanting to help the country do something about its drug problem. So the Nixon meeting, it was scheduled for 11:45 that same day in the Oval Office. So when Elvis arrived a few hours later, he was, and this is according to his biographer, high as a kite.
Yeah. I mean, he's clearly high as a kite through this entire
story. He is, yes.
Story.
He is. So he was baked and scratching at a facial rash the whole time.
Oh, my God.
So he wore a purple velvet suit with a boxing champion-style buckle, black cape, and amber-tinted sunglasses.
A cape.
It was a Luke. He came giving you, like, sloppy, old look.
This is clearly, like, later in Elvis's career when he's already kind of lost.
Sloppy Elvis realness.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a moment that... It looked...
Yeah.
There are photos, but they're only in black and white. Which
sure.
So
you can't tell that the suit is purple.
Purple.
Incredible. So this had to be towards the end of his life. Then.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
He wasn't really popular as much anymore.
No. So Elvis came bearing gifts for the president, that vintage Colt 45, and a supply of silver bullets. I'm like, is he a werewolf?
Is he going to kill vampire? Oh, werewolves, yeah.
I'm like, but I think it's because it's like a commemorative item that it's like decorative.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so usually when visitors arrive to see the president, like an aide brings them into the Roosevelt room and then they have to wait until the president is ready for them. The king was just escorted straight in.
Ooh.
Yeah, by Bud.
Well, he is a king after
all. It's true. You have
his royalty.
When Elvis entered... Schilling would later describe that with his swollen, reddened face and his black cape, the king looked like Dracula.
Yeah. I mean, literally, he must look like a lunatic. He's in sunglasses. He's scratching his swollen red face.
Yeah.
He shows up with a gun gift.
Yeah. It's such a wild, like, surreal picture of a meeting.
I feel like this is like the meeting between Trump and Kanye West.
A lot of people compare that.
Really?
Yes, a lot. So Elvis is in the Oval Office. He arrives, and within 30 seconds, like, he's kind of starstruck. Like, he can't say anything. He's kind of being shy and, like, weird, according to Bud, who's taking the records. So this is a quote from Bud. The president walked over and started a conversation. Immediately, Elvis whipped out his collection of police badges and showed them to Nixon. Then he displayed snapshots of his wife and daughter. It, like, became like a show and tell.
Sure.
Kind of vibe. Unfortunately, we don't have audio of this, which is so upsetting because Nixon hadn't installed his, like, spy system yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So all we have is Bud's notes from the meeting. He kind of writes in, like, a kind of bland bureaucratic style. But some of it is just, it is surreal. So this is another quote. Presley indicated that he had been playing in Las Vegas and that the president indicated that he was aware how difficult it is to perform in Las Vegas. So they're doing this like small.
The president knows all about that.
Right? I'm like.
Oh, yeah, I've played.
Right?
I played Vegas.
So fucking weird. It's like maybe he's just feeding off his high energy.
Yeah, I'm like, sure. He's just like, oh, sure.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So soon Elvis started ranting to Nixon in a drug-fueled tirade on the evil of drugs, which is really fun. The evil of drugs, communist propaganda, and the Beatles, who, according to him, were really anti-American.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This is a quote. The Beatles had been a real force for anti-American spirit. The Beatles came to this country, made their money, and then returned to England, where they promoted an anti-American theme. He would later say that the Beatles laid the groundwork for many of the problems that we're having with young people by their filthy, unkempt appearances and suggestive music. It's like, are you looking in the mirror, bitch? Like,
seriously, by the 70s, he looked like a mess.
He looked like he was dead.
Yeah.
Like, he looked... Ugh. And to be... Calling out someone else's unkept appearance.
He's just pissed because they were popular and he wasn't anymore.
Yeah.
They were the new Elvis after
his
career had dried up because he looked like a fucking lunatic.
Madness. Wow. So Bud wrote that while the president nodded in agreement, he expressed some surprise at the Beatles comments. Yeah. He's just like, bitch, what? So it's kind of like the first time that Nixon is like the less paranoid person in the room. Like,
he's the voice of reason.
Like, this dude's crazy. So the conversation quickly transitioned to just like general complaints about drugs and protest culture. Nixon continued to nod in agreement and said that it was young drug users who were at the forefront of like the protest movement. So Elvis, I mean, a 35-year-old current drug user, yeah. He, you know, blasted out of his mind on a cocktail of prescription drugs. He assured the president that he was on his side.
Yeah.
Against.
Well, it's fine because they're prescription drugs, so it's legal.
Yeah. So they chatted for about 20 minutes. Blasted Elvis kept scratching at his rash and volunteering, to fight in Nixon's war on drugs. Nixon kept nodding, possibly awkwardly, in agreement. Finally, Elvis popped the question, like, you know, now that we're like pals, bro, like, can I get one of those badges?
Oh, my God. To be a fly on the wall, right? In this room. Oh. Holy shit.
So Nixon like looks over to Bud and is like, do we have badges? And he's like, yeah, we have badges. Like, he's like, OK, give him one. He says, do it. Make it happen. Elvis is overcome with joy. He thanked Nixon emphatically, and then without warning, he grabbed his shoulders and hugged him.
I imagine Nixon's probably not a big hugger.
No. No.
Oh, wow.
Drugs, man. Wow. So as he was guided out of the office by Nixon, Elvis asked, you know, can you shake the hands of my friends, like the two guys who had come with him? Nixon agreed. So while the aides fetched his men, the president sat down and he started to sign a stack of papers. And when he finished, he turned to his aide and asked, what was that I just signed? And then apparently Elvis had a tee-hee over that.
Like, what did I sign?
Yeah. So when Elvis's friends arrived, Nixon gave the men commemorative White House cufflinks. But that wasn't enough for Elvis. He said, you know, sir, they've got wives. So Nixon gave them each souvenir White House brooches for the missus.
God.
And then the four men, they shook hands and they posed for over 28 pictures that are now
28
pictures that are now the most requested photographs in all of the National Archives.
What?
By far. These are the pictures that people want to see.
That's so weird. Yeah. But also 28 pictures back in the day of like film cameras, that's a lot of fucking pictures.
Yeah.
Like, I can take 28 pictures on my iPhone in like 3 seconds flat.
Yeah.
But back in the day, you're like, your old wind up point and shoot.
Mm-hmm. 28 pictures. So this whole bizarre encounter, it lasted less than a half an hour. At Elvis's request, it was kept secret, or private with a capital P. The White House staffers, they didn't really think that this event was worth leaking to the press. There was just so much going on at the time. They're just like, another crazy thing happened,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
But 13 months later, the White House chief of staff, the one who wrote, you must be kidding, mm-hmm. he leaked it to the press.
Okay.
So this is a
13 months, though. I wonder why they waited so long.
I know.
Yeah.
So weird.
A year and a half later or whatever, maybe he needed public support more.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this is a quote from the article. By presidential dictum, Elvis Presley, the swivel-hipped singer, has been issued a federal narcotics badge. And it went on to say that, quote, the emotional Presley was so overwhelmed at getting his own genuine gold-plated badge that tears sprang from his eyes, and he grabbed the president in a Hollywood bear hug.
A Hollywood bear hug. You know those famous Hollywood bear hugs?
Yeah, I'm like, what does that mean? It's just a bear hug.
Yeah.
So this story came at the height of the Vietnam War and the start of the presidential campaign. Okay, so no one gave a shit. No one took notice.
Yeah.
It flew under the radar.
And
it
was, also, Elvis was washed up at this
exactly.
point, too.
It was only years later, after Nixon's resignation and Elvis's death, that the meeting became legendary for its absurdity on almost every level.
Yeah.
Here was the most famous entertainer in history, zonked out on his mind, coming to the White House to denounce drugs, and still convinced the president to give him a federal narcotics badge. Elvis got what he wanted, a special assistance badge, which is a position that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It is now on display at Graceland. So oh, in a 1990 interview, Nixon recalled Presley's flamboyance in his dress and his shyness, but took major issue with those who criticized Elvis's drug use. Nixon said, without a trace of irony, that the drugs he took were prescription and not illegal.
Uh-huh. Of course.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. The end.
The end. That is the wildest fucking story I've ever heard on this show. Holy shit.
Oh, it was such a joy to research. I'm just like, what?
This is incredible.
He was pulling over people in Memphis? What?
Can you imagine you get pulled over and it's like, hi, I'm Elvis. I have no authority, but like, hey, don't speed. That's bad.
The police there fucking loved him. They let him do whatever he wanted.
Of course, because he's giving them money and shit.
He's giving them money, yeah. Yes.
You've shined a new light on Elvis. I like Elvis. I like Elvis's music. Certain songs. I like early Elvis where it's sort of more country, like rockabilly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I dig the more rockabilly. Later when it gets like really ballady, I'm not
familiar with his music so much. As in, but hound dog.
Yeah, that's earlier stuff that I kind of like. Yeah, but it's definitely.
It slaps, I get it.
I like the rockabilly stuff is fun because it doesn't feel like it's as much of like theft of black culture.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He put his own spin on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a nut job. Holy fuck.
Unbelievable. Like every detail in this story is just like my mouth is open.
The rash on his face.
The rash on his face.
Purple suit, sunglasses. He's wearing a
belt,
cape.
Cape, black cape, amber sunglasses.
Wrestling belt.
Gun.
Silver bullets.
Yep.
I love it.
I am that emoji with the hands out.
Wow. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
That is.
Thought it was a good one.
I think it's time for more cocktails.
Yeah.
I'm going to do some barbiturates. And
yeah. Some testosterone and
antihistamines.
Antihistamines, yes. Yes.
And maybe some X-lax.
A smidge of X-lax.
I think X-lax goes really well with White Russians.
I could see that. Yeah. I could see that.
Some milk of magnesia instead of half and half.
Ew. Yuck.
Okay.
Yuck.
It's time for a break.
Love? Do you like love?
Then you might like More Than a Crush.
I'm Kim Berry.
And I'm Marion Bolognese. We're the hosts of More Than a Crush podcast.
Each week, we pick a theme and share a story.
We also have interviews and share your love stories.
So tune in. It may be rotten out there, but it's feel good in here.
More Than a Crush podcast. Listen on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast directory.
Bye. Bye.
Whew, and we're back.
Yes.
Just listened to some Elvis.
We did. Return to Sender.
Return to Sender. Yeah, that's like one of my favorite Elvis songs. Definitely not one of the more rockabilly ones, but I like that song. Anyways, my story today is also from the 70s, as we've already said. It is not as fun as that story.
I mean, nothing is.
Yeah, nothing can compare.
My story was absurd and ridiculous on every level. So.
I'm still smiling. That was incredible. I can't believe it. Holy shit. I will be thinking about that story like when I go to bed.
As you
like,
should. Yeah.
Next week. So today I'm actually talking about Nixon's second vice president, Ford. Stephanie very briefly mentioned Spiro Agnew in her story, but I'm actually talking about Nixon's second VP after he became president. I feel like you've probably heard this or seen this at some point somewhere, but maybe not. We'll see. So in the 1970s, the New York Daily News published a headline that said, Ford to City, drop dead. Have you seen that? Do you know what I'm talking about? Oh, okay. I have a picture of it. I'll show you.
He's telling New York City to drop dead?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
No. Okay.
It was like huge, huge font up at the top of the page. So technically, President Gerald Ford never actually said drop dead to New York City. But the fact remains that during a really dangerous and really scary financial crisis, when New York City was on the verge of bankruptcy and had asked the federal government for help, Ford's response was basically, New York City, I don't know her.
Did the Mariah.
Yes.
Ooh. Cold-blooded.
Yes. So I would like to propose a toast to cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yes. Cheers.
I understand why people like this so much in the 70s. It is very easy to drink.
It is so drinkable.
Yeah.
It doesn't taste like there's any alcohol in it. Yeah. And that's the that's why I don't like vodka.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's the danger of vodka. Mm-hmm.
I think the reason vodka wasn't liked that much before was that, like, gin has a flavor and and whiskey has a flavor and rum has a flavor. Yeah. And everyone's like, why would I want to drink something that doesn't have any flavor?
Yeah.
But then in the 70s, people were like, why would I want to drink something that tastes really strong? When I could drink something that tastes like candy and get toasted.
It's a drink for people who don't like the taste of alcohol.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand.
Yeah.
I really don't.
So a lot of the reasons that New York City was having such financial trouble at this point in the first place in the mid-70s go back to Robert Moses.
Oh, our
nemesis.
That man.
Yeah. Mm. So I know we've kind of talked a little bit about Robert Moses on the show before, just in passing, like, fuck him.
There's a lot to say.
Yeah. I hope that someday we'll get around to doing a full story about Robert Moses. He is not the focus of my story today at all.
Yeah.
He just kind of laid the foundation for my story. All you need to know for today, if you don't know who Robert Moses is already, is that he was a very powerful and very influential city planner who basically reshaped New York City from the 1920s through the 1960s. So he did some really, really good things for New York City. He reshaped New York in a lot of ways that benefit us today, but he also did some really, really horrible things to this city because he really only cared about making the city better for the white middle class. He didn't give a shit about anyone else.
Yeah.
He also had a real hard-on for the idea of the suburbs and basically single-handedly drafted the plans for the bridges and tunnels and highways that made it easier for the white middle class to, you know, easily drive in and out of the city so that they could work in Manhattan and buy homes in Long Island and Westchester and New Jersey or whatever. In doing this, he completely devastated poor black and brown communities throughout the entire city. And he had no problem whatsoever ripping giant holes through well-established but undesirable neighborhoods if they fell in the proposed plan of a highway that he wanted to build.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So he did do some good things for the city, but he was a real piece of shit.
I like the idea of a grid, but it's like I know that there are people who lost a lot of property because of the grid.
I mean, the grid in Manhattan was already kind of set up before him.
Yeah. Oh, I thought
they had planned the grid system, like the grid was going in the 1800s. Yeah.
Oh.
It was more the highways that he, like, the BQE, the ripped holes through established neighborhoods.
Did he do the West Side Highway?
Yeah. All of the highways.
All the highways.
All the highways. Yeah. Mm. But those were not a part of the grid. They ripped the grid up to like make room for highways and new bridges and stuff. But the one thing that he didn't really consider when he was doing all of this was that once all these white people, all the middle class and the rich white people had moved out to the burbs, they would be working and making their money in the city, but then taking their money out somewhere else to spend it and pay their taxes and pay their property taxes somewhere outside of New York. So he basically drained all this money away from New York out into the outlying areas. Which he hadn't, you know, he didn't really think about that when he was setting this up.
Downstream consequences.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So by the 1970s, the city just couldn't support themselves anymore. This wasn't the only reason this was happening. It also had a lot to do with the loss of about a million manufacturing jobs since 1945, which also have something to do with white flight and which he helped create.
Sure does.
But it also at play here were some really bad decision-making on the side of city government. There was really, really terrible accounting practices, bad investments, and just fiscal mismanagement for decades that had kind of screwed the city over. The city had started running on a budget deficit in the 1960s, the early 60s, but thinking this was going to be just sort of like a temporary situation and things were eventually going to get better, they decided at the time that rather than raising taxes or cutting city services or cutting the budget, they were just going to take out some loans to cover operating costs.
That's the worst idea.
Yeah.
Like, let's dig the hole deeper.
Yeah. They just thought it was temporary. It's going to get better.
Loans from who and at what rates?
Bad rates from Jesus. Wall Street. Yeah.
Oh, no. From
Wall Street bankers. Yeah. Yeah. It's
These weren't
it's,
government loans? They no. went to
private banks.
Wow.
So things never got better. And then they had to take out additional loans.
The markets will provide.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But so they didn't. The markets did not provide. They provided loans.
Oh, yes. At crazy usury rates.
Yes. And so, the next year when things just got worse, they're like, oh, shit, now we have to take out more loans. And then more loans on top of that. And then it got to a point.
Okay, I'm sorry. Who is in charge of the budgeting?
By the 70s, we were under Mayor Abraham Beam. It started about a decade early, more than a decade before him. So I don't know officially who set this up. But this was bad decision making. This was bad fiscal policy. It was fucked up all around. And so as we took out more and more loans, we were paying interest on an ever increasing amount of debt. And it got to the point where we were in a downward spiral. It started slowly at first, but by the time we got to the 1970s, the entire country is in a financial slump in the 70s. Yeah. And New York City was literally in a nosedive. It got to a point where the money that was coming into the city was basically only going to pay off our debt. And we couldn't pay for everyday expenses
anymore.
Oh my
God, wow.
The roads and infrastructure across the city were crumbling. The subway system was always breaking down. It was dirty. It was dangerous. It was scary. At this point, there was violent crime all over the city in the 70s. The streets were filled with pickpockets and drug dealers. In a single decade, the number of murders had more than doubled in the city. So had car thefts and assaults. And the numbers of rapes and burglaries had more than tripled. From 1965 to 1975, the number of robberies in New York City increased tenfold.
People are just so desperate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And everything is just falling apart around them. Anyone who could afford to leave did. And then they left behind a whole fuck ton of vacant buildings.
I feel like that's what's happening right now.
Yeah. Well, I think people will come back once COVID.
I think so too. Yeah. But yeah, white flight is never good.
Yeah.
And it's like, I almost don't want them to come back because it's like, you don't even belong here.
I could use cheap
rent. If you're so skittish, like move to Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
If you're so afraid to be around your neighbors, like this is not the city for you.
Yeah.
But they're just here for
we need their tax money.
We do need their tax money and they're only here for the rooftop bars.
Yeah, exactly.
And when they're closed, it's like.
Yeah. So all these vacant buildings started filling up with squatters and junkies. And the thing was, New York before this, even up until the 1950s, New York City had a thriving middle class. It was not just a city for the wealthy. It was a city for the middle class. The Bronx were considered a beacon of the white middle class.
Yeah.
All the way up until the 1950s. But by the 1970s, people in the city, it was sort of like a running joke in the city that the Bronx is burning. If you said the Bronx is burning, everyone knew what you were talking about.
Yeah.
And that was because all these vacant buildings were so expensive to keep up that the landlords just started burning down the buildings for insurance money instead. This is New York in the 1970s. This is the New York of the movies, of those like gritty.
Lawless.
Yeah, totally. And, I mean, a lot of it was exaggerated in the movies, but it really was like that in a lot of ways. This is those like gritty, dark crime dramas of the 70s, like Serpico and Taxi Driver, Dog Day Afternoon.
It's a city that was left to its own devices.
Yeah.
It's kind of like what's happening across the country now that no one's really caring about COVID.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's just like,
everyone, it's
figure
the
it
Wild
out
West.
Yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So in June of 1975, travelers flying into New York City's airports were met in the terminals by people handing out these little paper pamphlets. And on the pamphlets, on the cover, they featured a picture of a hooded skull. And it says, "Welcome to Fear City, a survival guide for visitors to the city of New York."
Oh, that's
we'll put this on our Instagram.
That's amazing.
Yes. So would
Fear City?
Fear City.
What white person put this together?
So would you like to guess who was in, who was responsible for printing and distributing these pamphlets?
Some white man?
The NYPD.
Oh, that's, yeah, the ultimate white man.
The NYPD. Just the NYPD. It was, police unions had gotten together with the unions of the FDNY, corrections officers, and about 25 other municipal labor unions across the city.
Oh, okay, weird.
They formed the Council for Public Safety because they were pissed off that the city's mayor, Abe Beame, wanted to lay off city employees. And they were like, no, fuck you. You're going to make New York City even more dangerous if you do this because the police won't be on the streets.
Oh, yes. We need to fund the police always.
Yeah, exactly.
Forever. Because they do such great work for us.
So inside the pamphlet, it says, until things change, stay away from New York City if you possibly can. And then there's a list of 9 guidelines.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's kind of long. Excited. But I will read the headlines of each guideline. So stay off the streets after 6 p.m. Do not walk. And then, like, it basically says, like, if you have to go somewhere, take a taxi.
Okay.
Because it's not safe to walk. Avoid public transportation. Remain in Manhattan. Protect your property. Safeguard your handbag. Conceal property in automobiles. Do not leave valuables in hotel rooms.
Oh, okay.
And be aware of fire hazards.
I mean, all these things are common. I mean, not don't walk on the street because that's insane. But
the way they, like,
they're trying to scare people.
They're trying to scare people. Yeah, that's the thing.
Because the police can't function if people aren't afraid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mayor Beame called the printing and distributing of this pamphlet a new low in irresponsibility. And he actually took the Council for Public Safety to court. But he lost.
Whoa.
The New York Times wrote, unions representing policemen, firemen, and other public safety officers won affirmation in court yesterday of their constitutional right to pass out Fear City leaflets at transportation terminals, hotels, and shopping districts. The unions, however, faced mounting criticism of their tactics in attempting to pressure the Beame administration to rescind planned layoffs of 10,962 uniformed officers. They're trying to lay off like 11,000 police officers, but the city was desperate to try and save money in some way.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the only thing they were doing either. There's a lot of other stuff going on too. And the thing is, these pamphlets, like you said, the city just, or the police officers just want to drum up fear to make people tell the mayor that they're necessary. Don't fire them because we need them to protect us. A lot of the examples that are given under these headings are, most of it's complete ridiculous exaggerations, if not straight up lies about what's going on. New York City was not completely unsafe after 6 p.m. Midtown was not the only safe neighborhood to be in. There were plenty of people living totally normal lives in New York City in the 70s.
Yeah.
Even in the outer boroughs, there were still people living their lives and totally fine.
Of course.
New York was dangerous in the 70s. It was a lot more dangerous than it is now, but it wasn't.
Everywhere is dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. There had been some hotel robberies. There had been some hotel fires. But there was not this urgency that they needed to drum up this fear to, like, make tourists worry that every moment in New York was like risking their lives. There was no reason for this.
And that's just like a bad thing for the city because it's like you don't want tourists to come here and spend their money.
Exactly.
It's like we need their money, right?
So obviously, if the fucking city is in such bad financial trouble that they can't even pay your salaries and want to lay you off because there's not enough tax money coming in, the best thing to do is to take away their tourist dollars too?
Yes.
Like what? That'll learn them.
I mean, if this was my story, I'd say because drugs.
This is because Caucasity. Oh, man. So thankfully, all the negative publicity that came from the printing and distributing this pamphlet made them stop doing it.
I can't believe they did this for so long.
Yeah, it didn't last very long. Actually. Okay. They only did it for a couple of days before all the newspapers were like, fuck all of y'all.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
No, literally only a couple of days. They didn't get to distribute very many of them at all before everyone was like,
I can't believe they thought that they could get away with that.
Yeah.
Like,
they went to court. I mean,
everyone will see the graphic. It's like, it looks like Skeletor. Like, it looks like a joke.
Wow. Yeah, the fact that they won in court, but they lost in the court of public opinion.
Which is the only court that matters.
Yeah, exactly. So they stopped distributing it, and the city did decide not to lay off as many police officers as they planned originally. Mm-hmm. But when the next month they did lay off 3,000 officers, the NYPD just started printing new pamphlets, this time aimed at New York City residents with the title, "If You Haven't Been Mugged Yet." Like, fuck you. Fuck you, like, yeah. Multiple times.
And not in a good way.
No.
Like, fuck you by, like...
Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Which is never in a good way.
Yeah.
Because look at them.
Yeah. And like I said, the city was in dire straits at this point. And these layoffs were not the only thing that they had planned to do to try and fix it.
Yeah, I'm sure they cut all public services.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure there's no... I mean, what little safety net that... I mean, it's like a thread...
Yeah.
Subnet.
Yeah, exactly.
To protect the most vulnerable people. I'm sure it was cut.
Yeah. Yeah. About a month or a couple of months before this, in mid-April, the city had literally run out of money. Like, no money in the bank Damn. Account whatsoever. And Mayor Beam and the state governor, Hugh Carey, had gone repeatedly to the federal government and asked them for help, for aid from the government. And they were straight up ignored. The government was like, no, you'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. So finally, Governor Carey, at this point, when we ran out of money, like literally no money in the bank account whatsoever, Governor Carey was like, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to divert funds from the state budget and divert them to the city so you guys can at least pay your bills.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I will do this under the condition that you turn over financial management to the state. So... there were some really serious reforms planned, including tens of thousands of layoffs, which we've already covered, but also a wage freeze for city employees across the board, a huge subway and bus fare hike from the MTA, which, like, surprise.
I know, but say,
but this is kind of where this comes from. Like, before, the MTA wasn't doing this whenever they got themselves into trouble.
Is it because it's all controlled by Albany now?
I don't know if things went back to city control or what.
I don't think it.
Yeah.
That was part of, what's her name from Sex and the City running?
Cynthia Nixon.
Yeah.
Something she wanted to return to us, which we should have returned this
years
ago.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Years ago. Yeah. Like, when I heard that, I'm just like, Albany is controlling the subway?
It's because.
But how?
It's because of this.
Okay.
It's because of this. It doesn't make any sense.
Wow.
There was also a plan to drastically cut the city's budget for welfare spending, as
of
you
course,
already
yes.
mentioned, any social safety net.
Yeah.
The closing of several public hospitals, libraries, and fire stations, and to start charging tuition at City University of New York. Which, if you live in New York, you
wow.
will recognize that as a CUNY school.
Yeah.
We call them CUNY schools. There are a bunch of CUNY schools in New York now, but before this, they used to be free, and they are not anymore.
They used to be free?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my.
Yeah.
So New York was like Europe?
Founded in 1847 as the Free Academy.
Wow.
And had been free to all New Yorkers since 1847.
Holy shit. Wow. That explains so much. There's so many, like, black intellectuals who got educated through that system.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
But so on top of all that, the city, well, and the state at this point, also asked all of New York City's municipal labor unions to put up $2.5 billion of their pension funds and buy city bonds. Invest $2.5 billion of their pensions in city bonds so that they could use that money to pay their bills until they had to pay it back. This obviously put the pensions at risk. So if the city did go bankrupt, everyone who had fucked with their pensions was going to be screwed over by this. Which is why I think a lot of these municipal labor unions were so pissed about the plan for layoffs on top of it, because they had already risked their pensions. And then
yeah.
they're like, oh, and by the way, you're going to be laid off anyways. But it also stands to reason, like, if the city didn't lay off enough people and couldn't make up the difference in the budget, then everyone would be fucked whether you had a job
yeah.
or not. But I get mm-hmm. it. Like, everyone was just pissed off. It fucking sucked. It sucked. Mm-hmm. And everyone was being screwed over, not just city employees. Everyone living here was being screwed the fuck
like.
Over. And these, like, shitty stopgap efforts that were being put into place to like plug the holes because of all this terrible financial mismanagement for so many years had lasting consequences. CUNY schools, you still have to pay tuition to this day.
Yeah.
This is, you know, 45 years later, yeah. 45 years later, and we're still paying
tuition.
I never
knew that they were free.
Yeah. And today, every time the MTA gets themselves into financial trouble, they pass the buck on to strap hangers and city residents who have to rely on the subway to get to work every day. And that was not the case up until then. And now they're just like, oh, if we get ourselves into trouble, they have to pay for it, not us. So we can do whatever the fuck we want. And now they seem to get themselves into financial trouble every couple of years. And the cost of the MTA just keeps going up and up and up. Even after all these drastic budget cuts and after the drama of the Fear City pamphlet, after all of that, the city still wasn't able to get their financials in order. We were $14 billion in debt.
Jesus.
$14 billion in debt. And $6 billion of that was short-term debt that was supposed to be paid off within the year. $6 billion. Wow. Meanwhile, the entire annual operating budget for the city was $11.5 billion.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. $6 billion in 1975 dollars, too. Like,
yeah. Whoa.
What the fuck?
Jesus.
So as it became clearer and clearer how bad things were and how like fucked up the city was at this point, Wall Street bankers who had helped the city dig itself into this hole in the first place were suddenly like, oh, y'all are a bad risk and we're not going to loan you any more money. That's a bad idea on our part, even though we helped you make this problem in the first place. But they're like, no, we need to step away from this. Sorry, it's above me now.
It's... Yes. Oh my God. There's this amazing, we're going to put it in the show notes, video of this man who's working at a hotel and was called the N-word by some white woman. And then she shows up to, I guess, check into her hotel. And he's just like, no, actually, it's been canceled because you... said you called me an effing N-word and you know it's just above me now.
Yeah, it's above me
now. It's above me now. I like to help you, but it's just above me now. You can go next door to the Best Western, but again, it's above me now.
Yeah.
Best dodge ever.
Yeah. They couldn't get any more money from Wall Street. The federal government wasn't offering any help. And on October 16th, 1975, things were looking really fucking desperate. We'd run out of money again, and a lot of our loan payments were coming due. Mm. And it turned out that we were over $400 million short to pay our loan payments. And if we didn't come up with that money the next day, we were going to go into bankruptcy. The next day.
What does that mean for a city to be bankrupt, though?
It's kind of unclear. They like had to figure it out. Like, they didn't really even know what that would mean, but they had to sort of plan for it. I don't even really know.
Yeah.
But so to prevent this from happening, their plan was, we're just going to go back to the municipal labor unions and ask them for more money again, make them buy more bonds with their pensions. So they went to the teachers union and asked them to put
Ask the teachers who are already making $0?
Yeah.
Ask the cops who are...
I feel like at this point they think that the cops have too much power, so they go to the teachers instead.
Oh, okay.
So they asked the teachers to spend $150 million on city bonds. But the teachers' retirement system was like, look, we've already invested too much in y'all. And it's a fucking terrible idea for us to put all of the pensions' eggs into one basket. Yeah. Like, no, we're not going to do it. Ask somebody else. But somehow this was the city's last resort. So Mayor Beam got together with his team not to try and figure out where to get the money from or how to avoid bankruptcy, but instead just to figure out how the bankruptcy was going to play out and how to organize it when the city had no more money.
Okay.
So they're like, okay, we need to figure out which city services are absolutely essential. Mm. So they're like, okay, hospitals and fire departments have to keep running, but teachers aren't life and death. Literally, that's what teachers are not life and death.
Oh, no.
And the city ordered the sanitation department to stop issuing payroll checks. In fact, a lot of banks said that they would not cash the checks of city employees if the check wasn't from that bank itself. Wow. So the next morning, the New York Times publishes this headline, "Teachers reject $150 million loan city needs today." So like it's the teachers' fault. So many banks at this point owned New York City's debt because they had gone to so many banks to borrow from that people across the country were worried that if the city defaulted on these loans and the city went into bankruptcy, it would bring down at least 100 banks across the country. Wow. So people were freaking the fuck out. At the opening bell, the Dow dropped 10 points. Okay. And hearing about the crisis, Ford said, "I'll monitor the situation," but offered no help whatsoever. His press secretary said, "This is not a natural disaster or an act of God. It is a self-inflicted act by the people who have been running New York City for a long time." Which, like, he's not wrong.
Yeah.
He's not wrong.
Yeah.
However, we're not talking about making an example of a few politicians we don't agree with. We're talking about the lives of millions of people who live in this city.
Clearly, he's not familiar with, like, the details of what has been going on.
I think he was.
Oh, and
he
fuck. Just,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Governor Kerry and Mayor Beam had been going to the government repeatedly to ask for help, and he just kept saying no. So no one was stepping forward. No one was going to help. The banks weren't helping. The federal government wasn't helping. No other labor unions were like, "Sure, take my money." So the city went back to the teachers, and they were like, "Hey, I just want to remind you, just in case you forgot, if we go bankrupt and we don't find this money by 4 p.m., a judge could order thousands of teacher dismissals and undo the raises the teachers just recently negotiated through their union, and a judge could override pension laws and strip retirees of their pension checks." Like, just in case you forgot. So at the last minute, the teachers' union agreed to this deal and gave them $150 million. Wow. And the day was saved. The president of the United Federation of Teachers called it blackmail.
Because it was.
It was. And the day was saved temporarily. This was not the only loan payments we had to make for the rest of the year. This was a Band-Aid for one day. So the city went back again to the federal government to ask for help. 12 days later, President Gerald Ford stepped up to the podium at the National Press Club and gave a speech. "What I cannot understand and what nobody should condone is the blatant attempt in some quarters to frighten the American people and their representatives in Congress into panicky support of patently bad policy. The people of this country will not be stampeded. They will not panic when a few desperate New York City officials and bankers try to scare New York's mortgage payments out of them." He blamed New York's problems on high wages and pensions, its tuition-free university system, its city-run hospital system, and its welfare administration. He went on to say that the city's day of reckoning had come and said, "I can tell you and tell you now that I am prepared to veto any bill that has as its purpose a federal bailout of New York City to prevent a default." So the next morning after he made the speech, the usually conservative New York Daily News put out this headline in 144-point type, takes up the whole top of the page of the newspaper, "Ford to City, drop dead."
Yeah.
In London, the Times called Ford's position an act of monumental folly. The West German chancellor said that a New York default would have a domino effect striking other global financial centers. And the French president agreed, saying that internationally, the bankruptcy of New York City would be seen as the bankruptcy of America. So this could have had monumental repercussions. And Governor Kerry from New York was shook by Ford's speech. He was gooped.
Yeah.
He was gagged. He couldn't take it.
No, I'm like, whoa. So, you're going to let your financial center just like crumble?
Fall apart because you're trying to prove a point? And the thing was, Ford had a reputation for liking New York and liking New York City and being easy to work with and friendly and eager to make deals.
I know very little about Ford. All I know is that he was the only administration that was not going after Castro in Cuba.
Really?
He had zero like covert CIA operations under his administration.
He didn't have a full term, so.
Yeah, no, but still, that's significant.
Yeah.
Neither did Kennedy.
Yeah.
And he had a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
He had a lot. So.
Well, so a lot of people think that the whole reason that this was happening was that it was Ford's closest advisors egging him on from behind the scenes and telling him not to help. Do you have any guesses about who these advisors might be?
Ford. Okay. So is this like Dick Cheney? Is he in the mix? Not yet.
Yeah. He might have been.
Oh, is it Roger Stone?
It's Alan Greenspan.
Oh.
And Donald Rumsfeld.
Rumsfeld, yes. Obviously, yes.
So Alan Greenspan blamed New York for creating its own fiscal problems through liberal politics and social generosity.
Ooh, yes. Wow. Yes. Social generosity. Uh-huh. Like, that's a bad word.
Uh-huh. That's,
It should be corporate generosity.
Exactly.
Don't you know?
At the expense of the people.
Don't you know?
Yeah.
Free education for everyone, including, like, brown people.
Not just rich,
like,
people.
Fuck you.
And Donald Rumsfeld, who is from Illinois, somehow got it into his fucking peanut little head that if New York fell, Chicago would take over as the world's financial center.
Yeah.
Not London, not Paris, Chicago.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's very funny.
Chicago. Come on, Rummy. So a little bit of time went by and things were looking really fucking desperate for New York. And at this point, everyone was freaking the fuck out. The international community was really pressuring Ford to do something, to act, because literally the entire global economy could collapse because of this.
I feel like the same thing is currently kind of happening in Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago.
Yeah. It's a downstream effect of just white flight to the suburbs.
That makes sense. Yeah. So at this point, public sentiment was also on the side of New York City. 70% of Americans said that they supported some kind of relief for New York City, provided New York balanced its budget and that the loans were eventually repaid.
Of course. That's totally reasonable.
Yeah. Ford finally urged Congress to pass a bill to make $2.3 billion a year available to New York City for 3 years. In direct loans.
Okay.
And this federal credit line literally saved New York City's ass. Never went into bankruptcy. Everything was kind of okay after that. But Ford's reputation was destroyed because of this. He was too stubborn for too long and waited too long to act. And then when he finally did, conservatives were kind of like, well, why? You know what I mean? So New Yorkers at this point fucking hated him.
Of course.
Everyone couldn't, like, literally people are burning him in effigy. But conservatives were pissed at this point. And now his fellow Republican, Ronald Reagan, ran against him in the primaries, despite the fact that he was an incumbent president.
Yeah.
And had.
He's like, I got this.
Yeah.
This guy is flailing on the national stage. Like.
Yeah. So Reagan painted Ford as weak for giving in to New York City.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Thankfully, Reagan didn't win this nomination. So Ford went on to the general election, but then Jimmy Carter ran campaign ads locally that said, I'll never tell the people of the city of New York to drop dead.
Ooh, okay. You got my vote.
Yeah. So Carter received the third highest vote share a Democratic presidential candidate had ever received in New York City. And with it, he won the state's 41 electoral votes and the presidency. But at this point, this was a big deal because New York State was not the solid blue state that we think of today. New York had gone to Nixon 4 years earlier.
Really?
And did go to Reagan 4 years later.
Ew!
Yes.
Ugh!
It's because
disgusting.
Upstate New York is conservative.
It is very
and
red.
Remains conservative to this day.
Very much so.
But the population of New York was so much smaller that upstate had a lot more power than they do to this today.
Thankfully, those days are gone.
Yeah, exactly. Thankfully for upstate New York too, because the city makes so much tax money that benefits schools and roads.
Absolutely.
And I constantly hear people from upstate, because I'm from upstate New York, constantly hear people saying like, oh, fuck New York City. They don't have our best interest in mind.
You get all of our money.
Yeah. Like, literally, they want to talk. They're talking about seceding from New York City and becoming its own separate state.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Because New York City people won't let them frack in upstate New York.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. But like, do you not realize that?
It's so weird to want fracking.
I know.
They frack in Canton, like where I'm from now. Maybe even since under Obama. It's like been happening for a while.
It's because farming is becoming less and less profitable. And all of these people have farms upstate and think that they could make more money with fracking.
But I like, mean, you can make more money, but it's like at what cost?
Well, that's the whole thing about individuality. And like, I would make more money personally, so fuck everyone
else.
Exactly.
And it's
the entire state poison. Would fall apart if we didn't have New York City's tax money to pay for the schools and pay for the roads. And Ford later finally acknowledged that his political brinksmanship had literally cost him the election. An advisor to Mayor Beam said that Ford's speech, quote, galvanized New York like I've never seen before.
Of course, yeah.
Years later, Ford recalled, I never said New York City drop dead.
That wasn't me. I was on drugs.
it more than annoyed me because it wasn't accurate.
Oh, well,
it was very unfair.
Stop it. Is that what he said? It was very unfair?
Those are three separate quotes. Like, not
it was
all
very
that
unfair?
It was very unfair.
Oh.
Yes. So in 1977, Ed Koch replaced Mayor Beam as the mayor of New York City. By 78, we had already eliminated our short-term debt, thanks to the federal loans that we were getting. And eventually
we
did.
3 years?
3 years.
3 years is plenty of time.
Yeah, exactly. And eventually the city repaid those federal loans with interest. However.
It's a bummer about the colleges, though.
Well, so this is the thing. Those loans came with even more strings attached.
Yeah.
And more drastic budget
cuts.
They're
like, hey, stop doing things for poor people.
Exactly. Yeah. Public hospitals, health clinics, and schools were forced to close across the city.
Wow.
The workforce of New York City shrank by almost 70,000 people. The Board of Education lost so many teachers that they were forced to shorten the length of the school day by 90 minutes.
Whoa. Wow.
They literally just didn't have enough people in the schools to teach. And true to form, the NYPD was ready to die.
They're
mad.
Doing their best.
Oh, my God.
Blue lives, you know.
Yes. Have you heard about the blackouts in the
70s? Yeah.
In 77, in the summer of 77, there was a blackout that sparked rioting and looting across the city.
Yeah.
And it actually helped reshape Bushwick into the neighborhood that it became in the 80s and 90s.
I
the,
did
like,
not know that.
Scary, dangerous neighborhood.
Because I mean, before, scary, dangerous is just code for non-white people around.
There was a lot of crime. Knickerbocker Ave used to be called the Well, and people would drive from all over the city to go buy drugs.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that crime was not a thing. I'm just saying crime is a thing that's everywhere.
Yeah.
And like crime from black and brown people is you know, the worst type of crime.
In the eyes of like white people.
They're like, oh, drug use. And it's like if you went to shake down anyone on Wall Street.
Oh, yeah.
Literally anyone. Just like have
but
a
this
sting.
Is like violent crime and petty crime on the streets. Like businesses were constantly being broken into.
Brokers aren't shaking down people because they're shaking down this country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, the crime they're doing is different. It's not
it's
as
not
visible.
Desperation.
Exactly.
Because they have money. They don't need to do crime. Yeah.
But so when this blackout happened in the summer of 77, 40% of the off-duty force, about 10,000 cops, straight up ignored calls to report for duty to help with the blackout.
Yeah.
Because they were like, no, fuck you. You laid us off. Fuck you.
I mean, they're not about helping people ever. No. But that's clear.
In his book, The Assassination of New York, Robert Fitch wrote that municipal workers' wages and pensions never recovered. And he said that the fiscal crisis was actually a great boon to New York's elite class because New York, quote, got rid of the stock exchange tax, halved the personal income tax.
Oh, my God.
And set the real estate tax at a record low.
Whoa.
Yes. And Donald Trump himself got his his first major real estate deal from the city's devastation at this point. He was given the equivalent of more than $300 million in tax breaks to redevelop the Commodore Hotel near Grand Central.
Which after quickly this. Folded.
Let me tell you, I saw pictures of what the Commodore Hotel used to look like.
Was it beautiful?
It was stunning. Obviously, by the 70s, I'm sure it was run down and needed a rehab. But instead of restoring this beautiful architectural old New York building, he just fucking sheared off all the beauty and covered it in sheets of glass. This shit is shocked? So fucking ugly now compared to what it used to look like.
Ugh,
I mean, I know Donald Trump has no fucking taste and no class whatsoever, but also the 70s were a rough time for taste and class. Nobody
70s was like postmodern. There were places that were doing cute things.
Yeah, not the Commodore Hotel, definitely not Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, obviously.
Shocking no one. But so, yeah, these tax cuts were meant to be a temporary way to reinvigorate the private sector and bring in new businesses.
And I do get that. I do get, like, having incentives for new investment. It's...
No, I get it, too. But these were supposed to be temporary.
Yeah, it always should be temporary. It should be, like, 3 years max.
Yeah.
Max.
But you know this. We all know this. Yeah. Once you give people tax breaks, it's really hard to take them back away. These development strategies were supposed to bring in a bunch of good-paying, high-quality jobs as well, and they failed to do that. Instead, they helped to create the highly unequal city that we live in today. New York is definitely a very different place than it was 45 years ago.
Back then, one person could be working and buy a home.
Not today. It's nothing like that. It is so expensive here that even rents are so high that even commercial tenants can't hang on anymore. Before COVID, people across the city, businesses across the city, little mom and pops and neighborhood restaurants were closing. Yeah. But now with COVID, it's a fucking wasteland out there.
I hope they'll come back somehow.
It's just going to be Duane Reade chain stores after this. Yeah. It's going to be Chipotle and Duane
Reade. And then after that, it's like people who move to the city for like culture, they're not going to want to be here.
Yeah.
If it's just like chain restaurants.
There's not
going to
be any culture left.
Like,
yeah. The prices are going to come down because so many people have left.
Yeah.
Culture will come back.
That's true.
I hope.
Yeah. If prices come down and regular people or regular lucky people can buy property in the city, maybe. I don't know.
It's just, that would be incredible. Right. It's at this point, it's not even realistic to think that you could even buy a single family home is so out of reach.
In Staten Island, also known as COVID Island.
Yeah.
Like, no.
But it's basically the suburbs. It's not really part of the city. At any rate, New York City was once a beacon for what it looked like when a city worked for its people. I mean,
this
white
makes
people.
Me really,
we're talking white people.
Of course.
Let's be clear.
But still, it was like different types of white people. It wasn't just rich white people. It was like, if you were white and you didn't have a lot, like, you could still have a free education.
Yeah, free education.
Free education is fucking everything.
City-run public hospitals.
Wow. Free healthcare.
Affordable, efficient public transportation. It was like top of the line
at one
point.
I'm so depressed right now.
I know. All of this is long gone now.
Oh my God.
Some estimate that there are as many as 1 million millionaires in New York City today and over 100 billionaires. Over 100 billionaires living in Manhattan.
Wow.
More than 21% of the population, meanwhile, is living in poverty.
Yeah. Wow.
And now, thanks to COVID, the state, not just the city, but the state is facing a $15 billion budget deficit.
Every state is, though.
I know.
Thankfully, every state is.
But thankfully, today, now with this big budget deficit, Governor Cuomo is actually talking about raising taxes on the wealthy to help bridge the gap and pay for some of this stuff.
Communist.
I know. But even if he does do that stuff, there's still going to be some drastic cuts across the state, and we're all going to feel it.
Always, yes.
Well, that's the story. That's the story of Ford telling New York to drop dead.
That was a really good story.
It was not as fun as Elvis, but...
depressed a little bit.
I know.
But also, I feel really optimistic that there was a time when this was possible.
Like New York City literally was like a...
Sounds like Eden.
Across the country, everyone's like, look at what New York City is doing for people. And look what... There was a reason that so many people wanted to live here before white flight.
Like, of course, I understand it now. Wow.
People could have a really good life here. It is possible that it could come back, but we've got some work to do.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm hopeful because even though progress is not linear, things change and things are changing. It's just really, really slow.
I know.
But the fact that New York was here at one point, like, we can go back.
Yeah.
It's possible
it
here.
It is possible. It is possible.
Another thing to say, like, oh, Ohio can be like this. It's like, no, it can't. Yeah. Not in the next 200 years. But yeah. New York, possibly.
We just need to vote for some real progressive politicians. And de Blasio is not the one. Cuomo is not the one. It's really refreshing to see that he is actually talking about raising taxes on the wealthy, though.
Because he knows that his days are limited.
Yeah.
He knows that we're coming for him.
Yeah.
That's the only reason he's changing his tune.
And who knows if it'll actually happen. This is just a proposal at this point. Everyone's crying about how the rich are going to leave New York. I'm like, bitch, California currently has the highest tax on the wealthy in the entire country. And people are running there in droves. Everyone wants to live there. So it has nothing to do with the tax rate.
No.
Rich people are going to go there. And rich people will always want to live in New York City.
Rich people don't want to live in Iowa.
No.
They just don't 100%. Want to. So
Unless they're rich enough to have their own town, like the fucking Koch brothers.
But even then, it sounds like it's not cool. It's not a cool place to be.
Nobody ever accused the Koch brothers of being cool.
I feel like I know a lot more, and now I'm perhaps even more angry. It makes me feel optimistic that this did happen, and it did work for a moment. And like, there's a way to engineer a system that could shift back to that.
If there was still a middle class in New York City, we could still have this system in place.
A lot of them left.
Middle class definitely has shrank significantly.
But that's everywhere.
Since the 50s. Yeah, that's true.
Everywhere.
That's country. That's across the country for
and
sure.
And it's because of the policies that we have in place in this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's been a massive shift in wealth from the middle to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly tax-based.
Well, at some point, I really would like to talk about the marginal tax rate.
Ooh.
It's a really fun topic. This is why I haven't done this yet, because how fucking dry and boring can you get?
But it explains so much.
So much.
So much.
In the 1950s, when everyone loved America and America was so great.
It was
great
so great, you guys. Don't you know?
America.
Colored
the
water fountains.
Class, I know. Yeah.
So great.
But the middle class was strong because we had like a 90% marginal tax rate under Eisenhower.
Yep. And people didn't move to fucking, I don't know, the Philippines because taxes are so high here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lie that they kept saying over and over for decades and decades. And it's become the truth that
maybe
if you raise taxes, people will flee.
Eventually, we will do a mini about the marginal tax rate and what that means. I'm sure a lot of people don't even know what the fuck I'm talking about. It can be summed up in a mini.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I think it would be so important for the people who don't know.
My drink is empty.
Yeah, basically. I'm going to.
Look at that. That's the sound of vodka pouring down your throat.
That's the sound of a tasteless vodka.
It just tastes like candy.
It's an old person type of.
I love an old person flavor.
Of course.
Give me all the maple walnut, all
Tux
the butter pecan.
Like, can I get some?
Anything that tastes like butter.
Yeah.
Oh, give it to me. Sweet butter. Pound cake, shortbread cookies, butter toffee.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Yuck. I want all of it.
Okay. I do like pound cake.
Yeah.
So my drink is empty. Your drink is empty. Mm-hmm. So I guess we're done. America's history is juicy. We just add vodka and Kahlua and a bit of heavy cream and or half and half or a light cream if you fancy.
Oh, I saw all kinds of articles about how you could add almond milk.
Oh, no. Milk. Ew. Ew.
If you want your...
Tim, strike that from the record. I am not a... No. No.
Soy creamer.
Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. I'm Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tux Lurzel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, our sound engineer, our podfather, the love of our lives. We cannot do this without him.
Oh, I'm sending him heart eye emojis.
Yes, yes.
Mentally.
He feels it.
Yes.
He feels it. Psychically, he's feeling it right now, actually. Bye, guys.
Thanks, vodka. Bye.
'Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.